Welcome to Coffee with Kupke, a production of St. Paul Inside the Walls. Here on Coffee with Kupke, we grab a cup of coffee, at least we're claiming this is coffee. We sit with Monsignor Kupke, Raymond Kupke, the pastor of St. Anthony's in Hawthorne, professor at Immaculate Conception Seminary, diocesan archivist. We sit with Monsignor Kupke to delve into the history of Catholicism in the Diocese of Paterson. My name is Father Paul Manning. I am the vicar for evangelization for the Diocese of Paterson. And here I am with Monsignor Kupke. So grab your cup of coffee and let's jump right in. I'm going to take a sip. Welcome back, Monsignor Kupke.
Thank you, Father Paul.
Last time we spoke, we just touched the tip of the iceberg, that is Chapter 6, the dawn of a new age. So I said we're going to jump into some of the details now. And as a result of World War One,
the Great War, as they called it,
New Jersey ended up with kind of a more industrial feel to it. And in particular, you mentioned places that I knew in my youth still functioning in big ways. The Hercules plant.
Yeah, in Kenville. Right?
Picatinny Arsenal.
Picatinny Arsenal's been making bullets since the Revolutionary War.
Wow. And also the DuPont facility? So where was that? What was that? DuPont? Something with DuPont?
That was, I think, in Totowa.
Okay. And these were all operations that were creating munitions for the war?
Yeah. Or airplane parts or necessary.
Well, a little detail that you mentioned is that, a piece of Lindbergh's plane was manufactured in Jersey?
Yeah. Paterson, after the silk industry disappeared, it turned to airplanes. And for a while, that was the main industry in the city, airplane engines.
Aeronautical stuff, yeah. And submarines.
And submarines. You know, Picatinny Arsenal, you mentioned before, even in the 21st century, every time the Department of Defense looks at downsizing and closing, you know, they're on the list, but they always make it, you know. And I think part of the reason is that it's so close to New York.
Oh, okay.
You know, transportation, much like, you know, the religious orders.
Yeah.
Location, location, location.
And do you think the Department of Defense has any historical nostalgia?
No. They'd close West Point if they could get money for it.
Okay.
So, but, you know, just to go back to Picatinny, you know, the chain that the American rebels stretched across the Hudson River at West Point to keep the British fleet from coming down the river to New York.
I remember.
That was manufactured
in
Picatinny? Rockaway, in the mines of Morris County. And even today, there's a bridge across 287, a footbridge. And that was the bridge that they used – well, not a bridge then, but that was a trail that they used to bring up the links of the chain up to West Point.
Now, is that chain still – are pieces of it still around?
There are pieces of it at West Point decoratively around one of the monuments.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Wow. So in the 1920s, you talk about automobiles becoming coming on the scene, let's say.
And highways.
Yes. And you talk about pastors asking for permission to purchase parish automobiles. Right. Now, what's that about?
Basically, the thought of owning your own automobile was beyond their conception, but...
Because of the cost or just because it was uncommon?
Yeah. Nobody had one.
Okay. You know?
Even later on, we have a few commentaries on whether or not it was morally permissible to have chrome on an automobile, you know, or if that was too...
That was in my note, yeah. The stipulation was that the automobile be black without chrome.
I think in our first diocesan synod, there's actually a commentary on what an automobile of a priest would look like. By that time, though, it was the priests buying them. But initially,
yeah,
the parishes were looking at it.
I thought that's a great phrase for the way priests should comport themselves in general.
Black no chrome. Without chrome.
So that's the priestly aesthetic,
yeah.
Black without chrome. So you have parishes purchasing pastors purchasing parish automobiles. I'm thinking there's some pastors who would still like to do that.
Yes.
Maybe some of them who actually have.
Exactly.
And also this, they pave paradise to put up parking lots in parishes, right?
Yeah. And who did not have enough room to put up a parking lot, you know?
You can almost date the churches in our diocese by
how much property they have.
Yeah, by parking lots, right? This the early city parishes have no parking. Yeah.
I once asked Bishop Sweeney, he was here maybe a year, and I said to him in an aside, I said, so, you know, after a year, what's your first impression of us? And he thought for a moment and he says, I can't believe how much property some of these parishes have. Yeah,
that's true.
And that's coming from a Brooklyn perspective, you know, yeah. Where six cars is a parking lot.
Yeah, yeah. So highways are growing to such an extent that you say the Franciscans at Holy Angels in Little Falls introduced a devotion to Our Lady of the Highway.
Which is an old Jesuit, you know, the Madonna della Strada in Rome is like one of the first Jesuit shrines in Europe. And they kind of changed this to Our Lady of the Highway because if you think about that area before 280 and 80 and 287,
yeah.
You know, as people are beginning to drive to the Lake Country – on the weekends.
To the west, yeah.
You know, they are all going past Our Lady of the Holy Angels Church because yeah. Main Street in Little Falls there is like Route 7, Route 23.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can remember as a very young child, you know, the Little Falls traffic circle where 23 and 46 crossed. And on a Sunday afternoon, it would take an hour and a half to get through this circle
yes.
because there'd be so much traffic.
I feel like I'm really old when I say I remember Route 46 without Route 80. I don't know when 80 was built, but I remember going to see my cousins on Long Island on Route 46.
And it was endless.
Yeah.
So the Franciscans in Butler, you know, actually it was so – they were so hot on this that they had a medal struck. You know, they asked the bishop for permission for a special vote of mass – for Our Lady of the Highway.
Oh, my.
You know, it's interesting. Subsequent Franciscans were not as interested in this. But if you look at Holy Angels today, there is still that bell tower with Our Lady of the Highway.
Oh.
You know,
I'll have to look next time.
And on official lists of shrines in the United States, they are the one listed in our diocese as being a national shrine.
Yeah. There's one on Route 95. Is it outside of Baltimore, Washington?
Yes. Right at the Delaware-Maryland border.
Yeah. Is that a Franciscan place?
No. That is an oblace of St. Francis de Sales.
Okay.
And that dates from an accident in a terrible night of fog. At that point, there was a terrible pileup right
wow.
there. And the novices from the novitiate, which is, you know, were like coming down and rescuing people off out of the highway. And so they put up that shrine there.
But, yeah, very obvious as you're driving north, especially, I think.
Yes, it's almost exactly the half point between Patterson and Washington.
Okay, got it. And you and I have done that drive many
exactly.
times.
Exactly. I would wave to it many times saying, all right, we're halfway home.
Yeah. So the 20th century also saw what I'm going to call COVID-19-18.
The great influenza.
Right.
Right.
And
when COVID struck a few years ago and we were forced to close our churches, there were some people who felt that this was a unique
historical blip or something. Yeah.
Yeah, that this was an unprecedented intervention by the government in the life of the churches, closing churches.
Yes.
You know. So I had never really looked at that, but I looked in our records, and sure enough, for a couple of weeks, not as long as this time, but for a couple of weeks in 1918, two or three weeks, we closed all the churches on Sunday.
And there were a lot of deaths. Like, I was just wondering if anybody looked proportionally at COVID versus influenza.
I don't know that anybody has, but it was a major, you know, we lost a number of personnel in that influenza epidemic. The Sisters of Charity lost a couple of nuns who worked particularly in St. Mary's Hospital in Passaic.
Okay.
And All Souls in Morristown.
Yes.
It was a
big event.
It hit Philadelphia particularly hard because just as it was breaking and everybody was saying, you know, go hide, Philadelphia would not cancel a major parade welcoming home the Philadelphia boys who had fought in World War I.
Okay.
And they had the parade anyway, and as a result,
it spread.
It spread much more effectively in Philadelphia.
You also had around this time, a little bit later, the crash of the stock market, which would be about a decade later, right?
Right, which provided all these lovely homes in this area purchased on the cheap by Catholic. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you. So you have the mansions and estates changing hands, going from private owners to religious communities and congregations, and especially here where we are in Morristown and Madison.
Yeah.
The
Carmelites.
Yeah.
Delbarton.
Yeah.
The Jesuits.
Yeah. Yes.
Fairleigh Dickinson.
Right. Yeah. Drew.
True. Yeah. Everybody has bought.
So my question was the turnover of these properties, I always thought it was related to the introduction of income tax in 1913.
Yes, that was a major issue.
So that's why some of these properties turned over, and then the stock market
Stock market. Yeah. It was a combination.
Yeah, because this place, this didn't get turned over until 1940.
1940s.
So we have a Bishop of Newark, number four,
John
Bishop
O'Connor,
who had a very long tenure.
He did.
The longest for Newark?
I think he might be the longest.
Like it was 27 years or something.
Yeah.
How long was Bishop Rodimer our bishop?
27 years.
Okay, so that's a long tenure.
Yeah.
And it looks like he was in seminary formation for the first part of his life.
Yeah, he was at Seton Hall. He was kind of a mover and shaker. He had several jobs at the same time in the custom of the day. You know?
Yes.
So
returning to that custom, I think.
Yeah. So by the time Wigger dies in 1901.
Good old Wigger. We talked a lot about Wigger.
By the time he dies in 1901, O'Connor is something of an obvious candidate.
Yeah, you actually mention important ecclesiastical figures gathering, I think, in New York to
vote on the Turner to send to Rome. Yeah,
yeah. And
we don't do anymore.
He was on the top of the list.
Yeah,
yeah. Now it's very secret, the Turner.
Yeah, and not quite as democratic.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But O'Connor was an obvious choice.
Well, you have a beautiful line by someone who was in seminary under him who says his advice was like a benediction. His advice was like a benediction. I thought that was a beautiful description of his the way he dealt with
people
and seminarians.
He must have been to the point that we can judge somebody that's been dead 100 years. You know, a good bishop, because he presided over the Newark Diocese at a time of tremendous growth and change, and somehow, you know, made it all happen.
Yeah.
You know, the controversies that had existed under Wigger, you know, they disappeared. You know, you can see that, oddly enough, in his approach to Dean McNulty.
Okay, right. That's interesting.
So in O'Connor's early period there, McNulty celebrates the 50th anniversary as a priest.
Yes, and remember, McNulty and Wigger butted heads.
Butted heads, terribly.
Yeah.
So O'Connor offers to make McNulty a Monsignor in honor of his golden jubilee. You know,
yeah.
McNulty's response was basically too late with too little. You know, I should have been made a Monsignor decades ago. Yeah, and, you know, I'll just stick with being Dean. Thank you.
Yeah.
But O'Connor, you know, took the trouble to write that in the diocesan clergy register.
Oh, yes, I remember.
So that he would not be thought to be
the one who didn't let it happen.
Yeah. But, you know, that I think is typical of O'Connor. Kind of coming in and trying to soothe troubled waters.
Yeah, build
and,
bridges.
Yeah.
In 1905, so this would have been not long after Bishop O'Connor was made the bishop, you said there were, this blew me away, there were 480 Catholics in the whole county of Sussex.
Yeah.
So Sussex was still...
still out there.
Rural, yeah. And most of the action was, I guess, in Passaic, well... the Archdiocese of Newark was urban still.
Urban still,
yeah. He is responsible, Bishop O'Connor, for Darlington?
Right. It's under him that the seminary was moved from Seton Hall to Darlington.
Where you attended?
Where I attended, right.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about Darlington. Because for many of our older priests, an important place.
It's a beautiful place. You know, it was a shock to them to move up there. You know, they were not necessarily happy.
Because it was
the end of the world.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's hard to think of any place in New Jersey that way, but.
It was Mawa, right?
Mawa, you know.
Yeah, even the name is a little.
Well, you know.
Mawa.
There's an old clerical story that Mawa is an old Indian name for where the hell am I? And that's pretty much how they felt.
Yeah.
But they had kind of an idyllic life up there, you know. Today, if you drive up there, you know.
It's now housing, isn't it, or something?
Well, it's housing, but it's also a county park.
Oh.
The whole Ramapo County Park was all the seminary property. And we have some pictures of them, you know. They had a little beach area on the Ramapo River that they used, hiking in the mountains and everything. It was kind of idyllic. You know, it was a little bit – I think the faculty felt it in particular.
Oh, yeah, because they were removed from
– And they didn't all have cars.
Oh, okay.
So to be – even for a day off to try and get the train in Ramsey and get to any place else for a couple of hours and then, you know
– It was a lot.
Yeah.
What was it like for you at Darlington?
Hello, this is Bishop Kevin Sweeney of the Diocese of Paterson, and I have a new podcast called Beyond the Beacon. One of the things I love about this podcast is that I get to interview Catholics of different ages and backgrounds and learn what inspires them to live a life of faith, hope, and love. Join me on Thursdays for Beyond the Beacon, wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or watch it on my YouTube channel. Click the link in the description to learn more. Thank you, and God bless you.
My generation were there when everything changed. The Darlington that we entered in 1967.
Oh.
By the time
I forget you're that old.
By the time we were ordained, and happy 65th birthday, by the way.
That wasn't fair.
By the time we were ordained in 1973, there was almost nothing that was the same. You know, like when we would get together and talk about our first year there, the other guys at table would not know the terminology we were using, because a whole Latin culture, a whole isolation culture had just disappeared. And
so, Monsignor Kupke, you were there for 6 years?
The custom then was you went to Seton Hall Divinity School, that was called then, the minor seminary, for 2 years.
Okay.
And then went up to Darlington for 6 years.
Got it.
In the middle of the 6 years, after the first 2 years, you would get your degree from Seton Hall.
Your bachelor's degree.
Bachelor's degree.
Right. And then ultimately a master's. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I hate to leave Bishop O'Connor so quickly, but he's succeeded by Bishop Walsh?
Bishop Walsh, yes.
And so Bishop Walsh would have been the fifth?
The fifth bishop and the first archbishop.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And Bishop Walsh had Pennsylvania roots and then worked in New York?
Was born in western Pennsylvania, ultimately was ordained a priest of the Buffalo Diocese.
And then somehow ended up in Trenton.
Yes, he was, a mover and shaker, you know, a young Turk that was being watched. So he becomes Bishop of Trenton and then ultimately Bishop of Newark.
Okay.
He was very young when he was made a bishop. He was quite a character. We have a audio recording of him preaching at some event, and it's a style that is almost unbelievable by today's standards.
You know? In what way?
He would have been trained in a day before amplification.
Mm.
So they would have been trained, first of all, to talk very loud, and secondly, long pauses.
Yes.
So that, you know, so to listen to him preach on this recording is, you know, no one I know of preaches like this today, but and it gives you a window at how different.
This would be so interesting to hear.
Yeah, it's like, today, as we come,
got it.
Together on the feast, nobody.
And what is it? What medium is it recorded on? Is it a record?
Yeah, like vinyl record. A very thick vinyl record.
Yeah, interesting. Wow. The last thing that we're going to talk about in this episode is I'm going to give you a chance to talk about your parish of St. Anthony's in Hawthorne, because it's under Bishop Walsh, I think, that the parish is established, yes?
Yes, Walsh blessed the church.
Yeah, so a word about St. Anthony's and Bishop Walsh.
St. Anthony's would be typical of a number of churches in that period, that as they're founded. The movement is on the way from the downtown parts of the city.
Of Patterson,
all the cities, you know. Yeah. Suddenly the earliest suburbs are beginning to be formed.
Got it.
So Hawthorne on the north side of Patterson, Totowa on the west side of Patterson, you know, Elmwood Park, they're all beginning to experience growth because people are beginning to move out of the downtown. You know, I mean, the cathedral parish by this point is losing parishioners like crazy because everybody's moving out of the downtown.
Yeah.
So the original impetus for St. Anthony's comes around 1908, when a group of parishioners appeal to the pastor of Our Lady of Lourdes in Patterson, which was the parish of the area at the time.
Yes.
Asking if they could have catechism classes in Hawthorne, so the kids wouldn't have to walk down River Street in Patterson all the way to Our Lady of Lourdes.
Yeah, okay.
So the pastor of Our Lady of Lourdes at the time is Anthony Stein.
Yes.
Who was another big figure in early 20th century Patterson Catholic life. And he's open to this. It's interesting because it's a combination of Catholics from Hawthorne and also Fairlawn.
Yes.
Which is right next door.
Yeah.
So based on that, they start catechism classes, and within a year, you know, as happens anywhere, this happened out by you in Flanders.
Yes, yeah,
This is the same story, for St.
Elizabeth Eaton. Originally, yeah, yeah.
You know, they start to say Sunday Mass in a rented hall, and then the next thing you know,
people would like a church.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And the church, the parish, as far as I can understand, is named for Anthony Stein, of Our Lady of Lourdes.
Nice.
And had, in when the church was built, the church, the current church, will be 190 years old on Thanksgiving. But it had a very large Lourdes grotto inside, you know, connection to Our Lady of Lourdes.
Yeah. Well, next time we get together, we're going to talk more about this this new age for the Diocese of Paterson. And we'll pick up with St. James of the Marches. Let's leave it there. I want all of you who are listening or watching to make sure that you keep an eye out or an ear out for the next episode of Coffee with Kupke. In order to stay on top of new releases, make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you're listening. And if you are on YouTube, please do drop a like and hit the bell for notifications. While you're at it, make sure to check out the other shows produced by the diocese. Those shows are Beyond the Beacon, hosted by Bishop Kevin Sweeney and Jay Agnish, our Director of Communications, and The Paul Street Journal, hosted by Brian Hansberger and Freddie Garcia. I want to give a special thanks to Joe Genexi, our sound and visual engineer, Caitlin Ferrari, who's involved in pre and post production, and Freddie Garcia, who's helping out with this podcast in addition to doing his own. With all that said, I just want to thank you for joining us in Coffee with Kupke. Keep making Catholic history in the Diocese of Paterson.